All right, let's dive into Rome. Warren Carter didn't derail us. He just extended the conversation in the New Testament. We've just talked about the development of the Republic and the things of that nature, the seven things, I believe it was, that we described as emerging in the time period from 509 to what we're going to be describing now, and that's the rise of the Principate. Rise of the Principate. Which, what's the Principate, by the way? Yeah, the reign, the emperor model of government, as opposed to the Senate model of government that the Republic was dominated. What we're going to describe, let me lay out the terrain. We're going to describe the different things that occurred right at the end of the Republic that emerged into that, basically set the stage for Julius Caesar to seize all control. And this will come in two primary phases. We're going to see initially over in the 2nd century BC into the 1st century BC, three distinct people that kind of further the thinking of the society to the point where they were starting to become more warmed up to the idea of a single ruler over Rome. Then what you're going to have is you're going to have what's going to be called the triumvirate that we'll talk about that emerges because of some bad senatorial decisions. And ultimately the deterioration of the triumvirate will end with the emergence of Julius Caesar. That's what we're going to try to get through today. And then the next 3 days, we're going to finish up the discussion of the second triumvirate with Octavian and Augustus, which is eventually Augustus. And then we're going to have a day where you guys are going to talk to me about your emperors, and we're going to have a day and a half or so talking about society of Rome. Particularly, we're going to spend a lot of time on the honor-shame context, the foundation from which that impacts multiple different areas like politics, religion, war, gender issues, etc. Okay? All right. That's where we're headed. Let's move. The rise of the Principate. In the middle, the last half of the second century, at this point, there is still a major aversion towards the idea of a king or a dictator, a single ruler. And the reasons for that should be obvious. Why? Why would there be this keep away the single ruler model? Not rhetorical. Why? Why? Why would they have this aversion?
Because they kicked out the Etruscan
king? Yeah, exactly. Because what? The seven kings they had before the Republic, the last ones especially, didn't work out so well, did they? No, the Etruscan king was, matter of fact, the very last one, Superbus, he was the one that was the key archetypal tyrannical king. And they're like, no, one man gets that much power, the whole empire could suffer. And what happens after that, after they get rid of the king, depose of the king model, have the Republic, then what happens to the empire? In 509, what begins to happen over the next 400 years? Yeah. It starts to expand. They start to have all these wild successes militaristically. The Punic Wars, they overcome Carthage. They destroy Hannibal. They're right after the end of that. And they're going, hey, this Republic model is working pretty good. Where did the King model get us for 244 years? And where's the Republic model got us? Why would we want to go back? You see the issue? And there's obviously another issue as well. And that would be the people that are in power won't want to give it up. Because the very fact that there's a plurality of leadership, it doesn't mean that people still don't have a lust for power. You can just look at our politics just to prove that point very simply. We have checks and balances, kind of. But everybody grabs their power in different ways, whether it be through lobbyists or legislation or whatever. Or aligning with certain parties. Or tea parties, whatever you want to call them. Anyway, that's the climate that we're in. But a shift begins to emerge in the second half of the last half of the second century. So 150 on, you start to see a shift, and the shift will come through a couple of different avenues. The success of military conquests. What starts to happen is that key individuals, because of their success in military, they begin to become more widely recognized and honored, especially by the key power of Rome, and that is the army. Because we've developed this professional army, in a sense, the army, the soldiers become more loyal to the state, they become more loyal to their general than they do the state. And that actually will cause some problems. And there's some other elements that you'll see begin to emerge. Specifically, though, there are three failed attempts that occur in the middle of the 2nd century BC into the 1st century BC. Three failed attempts to seize power of Rome by one person. And these three failed attempts start to develop the the ground, lay the foundation that eventually Julius Caesar will reap the benefits of. The first one is from a guy, and I'm going to write these up here that way. You have them for the oral exam. Obviously, I'm not going to be testing you on pronunciation. Nevertheless, you've got to come close. The first guy is a guy by the name of Tiberius. Hello. Sound familiar? Gracchus. Who was the emperor at the time Jesus was living? Tiberius, yeah. Their lineage can kind of be pulled back to the different people. Ooh, I spelled that wrong. I was spelling it like the city and not the person. Tiberius Gracchus. 133 BC is the key date for Tiberius Gracchus. That isn't the year that he was born and lived. Tiberius Gracchus? Oh, 133 BC. 133 BC. I'll even write that next to him as well. 133, obviously you know it's BC, BCE, whatever. Tiberius Gracchus. Tiberius begins to push a new political agenda, and he does this by making a what seems to be a benign, maybe even a benevolent political suggestion. Tiberius, he said, well, I'll call him Gracchus so that we can keep him separate from the emperor to come. Gracchus, he suggests, you know what, we got a bunch of land that we acquired after the Second Punic War with Hannibal. We got a bunch. He says, so why don't we divvy that up and give it to some impoverished people that don't have land? And you're thinking, oh, what a nice guy. No, he's no dummy. You see, one of the ways they have a professional army, but you still couldn't, not just anybody still could be a part of the army. You still had to have some level of wealth to still be considered the dignity of the Roman army. And you, in particular, though, the way they gauged it was not how much money you had, but if you owned a certain amount of land, you could be a part of the army. And what he was doing by saying, let's divvy up this land and give it to the poor, was he was building an army that would be indebted to him for the dignity they would receive by being able to join the army. You following this? He says, hey, we got a bunch of land, let's just divvy it up and... What in the world? Okay. sorry, that just messed me up. What was I talking about? He says, let's divvy up the land that we've gotten and give it to all the poor. And the poor's going, yeah, buddy. And the Senate's going, oh, that's a political threat. Because what you're doing is wanting to develop an army that's dedicated to you. And that's actually the way that's what they accuse him of. It becomes so unpopular that eventually a political war starts between them. The Senate starts to pull funds away from Tiberius's efforts as a whole. Tiberius starts to attempt to bypass the Senate altogether to get this approved. He even starts to incite some kind of riotous movements in order to accomplish what he wants to accomplish. He tries to depose his fellow tribune, the guy that's ruling with him, because there's multiple levels of the Roman government that sends the primary of consuls and tribunes, and they have some power that is still held in check with the Senate. Nevertheless, there's two each. But this tribune's opposing his movement, and so he tries to get him deposed, which is a serious breach. Not to mention the fact Tiberius even starts to force his immediate re-election as tribune. You're usually only consul or tribune for 1 year. And he says, no, I need to be re-elected so that this can get passed. So you have this tug of war, this political seizing of power between the Senate and between Tiberius Gracchus. As a result, whenever the time came to vote for the bill, which was wildly popular because the impoverished people could be receiving some dignity, the Senate and the clients decided to take matters in their own hands, and what they did is they stormed the assembly, clubbed Tiberius and about 300 of his supporters to death, saying that he had committed a treasonous act against the empire, trying to seize it for his control. See what happens? But what happened in this event was quite significant for what eventually Julius Caesar will be able to actually accomplish. What happened was we see Tiberius has piqued the interest of the possibility of one man actually succeeding in seizing control of the empire. And that will be picked up 30 years later by a guy named Marcus Livius Drusus the Younger. Marcus Livius Drusus, and then the Younger. Oop, not Drusus. Drusus, the Younger. Okay? Marcus Livius Drusus, the Younger. And the key date for him is 91. What occurred in 133 was significant enough that people had it in the back of their minds that this could be possible to seize the control of the empire. And Marcus Livius, I'll just call him Drusus, that'll be easier. Drusus, he decides to take what Gracchus had developed and take it to a whole new level. But instead of trying to split up land, which people would have not been happy with anyway, because wealth is a limited commodity, and if it takes away from one person, give it to one person, it's taken away from someone else. What he decides to do is to use citizenship for his advantage. Specifically, there was wars that were going on between the Numidians and the Germans, and primarily that what was being used was both the professional Roman army and their cohorts, people that were subjected to Rome, that were enlisted in wars whenever Rome called on them. These people in particular that he decides to seize on were the non-Roman Italians. Now, what's significant about that label? Why would he go after the non-Roman Italians to enlist them as somebody that's indebted to him? Say it again, louder. Go ahead. Yeah. Because where is Rome located? Italy. And he says, you know what I'm going to do? Is I'm going to target all the Italians that are not Roman citizens and try to enlist them on my side. Because that makes the empire under duress at best and threatened at worst. As a result, in 95... Well, let me back up really quick. He enlists them in a moment. The non-Roman Italians, though, they wanted citizenship. They wanted the perks. So much so that in 95, 4 years before Drusus seizes upon this, in 95, they begin to rebel. The non-Roman Italians begin to rebel, and it had to be violently repressed by the Romans. So Drusus comes along in 91. He's elected tribunate. He gets his position. And what he says is, I propose that we legally enfranchise everyone that is a part of our country of Italy. And what do you think naturally happens to the Italians towards Drusus? Yeah, they're like, yeah, buddy, this is what we were trying to fight for just 4 or 5 years ago. We're dying in your wars. Why aren't you giving us anything? And Drusus says, we should give them something. And what ends up happening is all of them say, because you're fighting for us, we are indebted to you. Not to Rome, to you. As a matter of fact, they even announced that Drusus was considered the patron of all Italians. And Drusus comes along and he says, yeah, I'm also the patron, and he says this, of the Senate. That didn't go over very well. And as a result, because of the audacity that he had, he was rejected and stabbed by assassins. For what reason? A treasonous act against the empire, of trying to seize control of the entire empire. But where did he get the idea to begin with? Tiberius Gracchus. There's a possibility. He says, your tactic may not have been good because you're trying to give away land, but if I use citizenship and the way in which Rome used it against our enemies, against Rome itself, maybe I can seize what you failed to seize. And ultimately, the fate of Gracchus was the fate of Drusus, and that is death. Nevertheless, the precedent was set that force... political force, even violent force, could be something used, whether idle or real, as a threat against the city of Rome in order to seize power under one person. And that's what's significantly developed under Drusus. Any questions so far? Are you guys following me? He's killed all... Yeah, the Senate's killed all of them. Well, technically assassins, but... I mean, who is his enemy? Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. So right now, you're seeing a pattern. Okay. The next guy, Lucius Cornelius Sulla. We will call this guy Sulla, but I'll give you his full name. Lucius Cornelius Sulla. This name is very important. He's probably the most significant person in the development of the empire, or of the emperor model, out of all of them. These people lay down some groundwork. He takes it to a whole new level. In 88, it's the key date for him. Sulla was a very respected general. Very respected general. Matter of fact, he was one of the key generals that helped suppress the revolt of the Italians. It was called the Social Wars. If you ever hear of the Social Wars, that's the Italians trying to get their citizenship and revolting. And he was one of the key... Sulla was one of the key generals of suppressing the Social War. As a result, he was very well respected. Well, Because of his success, Sulla was awarded with the opportunity to suppress another revolt that was occurring by a guy named King Mithridates VI. Do you want me to write that down? Ooh, I might have to look. Mithridates. Where'd it go? There it is. Mithridates VI. Oop, that's an ES. Sorry. Mithridates. King Mithridates VI. He was the ruler over Pontus in Asia Minor. It was a place that was under Roman dominance, but allowed to be self-governing. Remember that we talked about how one of the political tools that they developed in the Republic was to allow people, even though they're subjected to Rome, to be self-governing, even allowing them to mint coins at times. King Mithridates, though, said, you know what, we are self-governing, but I'm tired of being subjected to Rome at all. So King Mithridates, over in Asia Minor, he thinks, I'm far away from Italy enough that I can start causing some problems in the East. As a result, they said, Sulla, we need your help. We want you to go over there and suppress this. Well, that would gain Sulla a lot of honor. Military victories were not something, if you were appointed, even this is really even in our society today. You know, the generals of the military are highly revered, General Petraeus, etc. Same thing then. High honor can be gained by being the general of a successful war. As a result, a guy by the name of Sulpicius Rufus. He was an enemy of Sulla. And what he decided was, even though Sulla had been appointed by the Senate, he got the Senate to revert their decision. To say, no, we're going to take it away from Sulla and give it to someone else. Well, that didn't sit too well with Sulla. So what he did instead was he fled Rome. He got out of Rome and went to his armies that were already in Asia Minor. And instead of, after destroying Mithridates almost completely, but not totality, he decided to take his army, turn him around, and go and launch an attack on Rome itself. Yeah, that's unprecedented. That has not happened. The civil war in Rome, especially inside the city, is not something they were used to. And he succeeds. He marches on Rome. He gets Rufus kicked out, banished. And he once again establishes himself as not an enemy of the state, but one that's a successor of the state, a statesman, if you will. And then what he does is he doesn't take the throne. He goes back to the war. He goes back over to Asia Minor and tries to finish what he had started with Mithridates. Well, while he's over there, some of the people that were still dedicated to Rufus decide, we're going to take back over the Senate, and we're going to once again make Sulla a fugitive. So they banish, they kick him out, and Sulla says, okay, here goes round two. So he turns around his army again, and he goes back, and this time what he does is he not only takes back Rome, but he sets himself up as the sole dictator of Rome. Because he realized every time he would leave, he would be vulnerable until he held all the power. And so what he did was this, though. This is kind of the deal he struck. He said, it's obvious that Rome's in disarray, and if we want to avoid any sort of more civil war, then we need to have one person to reform some laws to get rid of the rogue senators. So he says, I will be the sole dictator, but once I'm done reforming everything, I will give the power back. Okay? And guess what? He did. He really did. Sulla reforms everything, and incredibly in 80 BC, so 8 years later, in 80, Sulla did what he promised, and he gave the power back to the Senate. He demoted himself from dictator to consul, and in the following year, he retired in Campania, and he died in 78. Nevertheless, what was established? This is pretty significant. Because what these two had attempted to do never succeeded. But he takes his cues from the force that was used and says, you know what? For the first time, there will be a war fought in Rome over the power of Rome, and he succeeded. He had the dedication of his army, an army that was even willing to defy the decrees of the state in order because of their allegiance to one man. And Sulla even achieved dictatorship, but he was actually revered eventually because he reformed the Senate and gave it back to them. One of the key, this actually will be significant once we get to Julius Caesar, one of the key things that he did put into law was that never again is it allowed for a general to march past a certain point of the borders of Rome with their army. And if they did, it was a treasonous act that Rome then could declare war on their own army. So he kind of said, what I did is now illegal. No one else can do it again. Pretty substantial. So, for the first time ever, force actually utilized and secured political power. For the first time ever, for the first time in the last 400 years since the Republic took over, with the empire, this much power at stake. That's the first time ever. The army felt overwhelming allegiance to one man instead of the government, the state itself. For the first time ever, the city of Rome itself experienced civil war inside the city gates. And for the first time in over 400 years, Rome had a single ruler that held all the power of the empire. Now you're seeing the terrain that's developing here at the beginning of the first century BC. Because when does that occur? It eventually ends in 80 whenever he gives the power back. But it began in 88 when he declared war on Rome. Okay? So he gives the power back. We're into the first century BC now. Three different things occur in 62 to 60, so 20 years later or so, 15 to 20 years later, after this precedent had already been established. The Senate does three things that proves to be ultimately the downfall of the power of the Senate as a whole and the dissipation of the Republic. Three things. And all three of them are snubs against three different people. So the Senate will snub three different people. The first person they snub is in 62, and it's a guy by the name of Pompey. That name is very significant. Pompey. What's significant about that? What do we know about Pompey that happened in around 65? He marched on Judea and went into the Holy of Holies, and what did he find? What did he not find? He didn't find the Ark of the Covenant. It wasn't there. Pompey is pretty significant, but notice whenever he did that in 65. 62, he comes back from his wars in the east, whenever he's regained control over there, and he suppressed, really kind of solidifying the movement of the Roman Empire into the extending regions of the Greek Empire. He's one of the major figures that helped solidify that. As a result, he's a war hero, very well respected, very deeply honored. And this is what he does. He comes back and he asks the Senate this. He asks for two things. Number one, Pompey asks that some land would be awarded to his veterans that are now retiring. He said, we need to give them something for their sacrifice. And the second thing he requests is that all of his acts of war, actions inside of the wars in Asia, would be ratified as decisions of the Roman state. That's significant because what he's saying is there were times whenever I played by the rules and times I bent the rules. Nevertheless, in order for people not to prosecute me, I need the Roman state to say everything you did was by our control. But in the heat of the war, he can't keep on sending people back from the east to ask permission. He's got to make decisions. And these requests actually were not really unique. These are very normal requests for military conquests. To reward some of the people that are now in retirement, your veterans, as well as ratifying the decisions that you made as decisions of the state. Nevertheless, a man by the name of Cato, with a C. Cato, this is the guy that really screws up the Republic. Cato, in 62, he convinces the Senate to block all of Pompey's requests. He's like, no, let's not do that. Let's instead reject both requests. So your veterans will not be rewarded, and you can be prosecuted for the decisions that you've made. As you might imagine, this created some animosity between Pompey and the Senate. Not just Cato, but the Senate. That's the first snub. Here comes the second. In 61, a man by the name of Crassus. In 61. Crassus, he was a part of some military, he was a military leader of sorts. He was kind of one of the go-to men for Sulla inside of Sulla's wars. So when Sulla's doing the civil war, Crassus was a part of it. But Crassus never really got much of the glory. And this will come into play later once we get to the end of the triumvirate. But Crassus, so he was a military man, but really, primarily, he was a businessman and a politician. That's what Crassus was. As a matter of fact, Crassus, some even believe that he may have been the richest person in the history of civilization. Not just the richest man in Rome. Maybe, in comparison, you know, obviously comparing what their value to our value, maybe the richest person to ever exist in a civilization is Crassus. Very good businessman. Crassus, though, honestly, was not really particularly a fan of Pompey. In 62, whenever Pompey came back, my goodness, what do I have written up here? Pompey in 62, whenever he came back, Crassus was actually really offended by the way Pompey re-entered into Rome, as if he owned the place. And Crassus was one of the supporters of Cato whenever he said, no, we need to deny this person his requests. But what happens is that Crassus in 61, he brings a small financial matter to the Senate. He basically has some knights that are clients of his. We'll talk about patron-client relationships in a week or so. That are clients of his that they just wanted a tax rebate for some of the different things they had to pay even though they were in war. And Cato, for some reason, honestly, we don't really know why, Cato snubbed him too. He said, we're not going to grant that, which was very shameful for Crassus. He made him look like a fool. He's the representative of these knights that are indebted to him, and they're saying, hey, if you want to repay our debt, then have some tax rebates and some of the stuff we had to pay when we were in war. Not a big request. But Cato says, no, we're not doing that either. Which results in Crassus saying, now I'm not too big of a fan of the Senate. Then the third snub. Third snub came in 60. So three consecutive years. You have 62. You have Pompey, 61, Crassus, and in 60, you have a man by the name of Julius Caesar. In 60. The Senate snubs him too. What happens is this, Julius Caesar, he had in further Spain, so not in the east, but in the west of the empire, he has some victories. They weren't over-the-top victories, but they were enough where he was granted a Roman triumph. They're like, yeah, you deserve to be rewarded and honored for what you've done. Well, Cato comes along, and he convinces the Senate to reject Caesar's application for a triumph. Then, in 59, whenever Caesar was going to be, he was up to be proconsul for the following year. In 60, the elections were going to see who could be the consul. One of the two highest offices were the two consuls, according, you know, in the checks and balances with the Senate, consuls, tribunes. So he's up for it, and what it does is Cato also gets the Senate to pass the duties of what the consuls would be for the following year. And he says, yeah, the consul, one of the consuls will be in charge of, their political reign will be over the forests and the cattle drifts of Italy. If you heard that was what you were ruling over, what would you think? Yeah, you're shaking your head, Stephanie. What are you thinking?
That's silly.
Absolutely, that's a flat out ridiculous trivial area of influence. You're over the cattle and the forests. And Caesar's going, you denied my triumph. Now you're going to put me over the forests and the cattle. So what naturally do you think developed with Caesar? Animosity towards the Senate. You see what's happening? What eventually happens is this. All three of these guys, even though they weren't even really friends, Crassus was really not a big fan of Pompey. None of them really liked Julius Caesar. They weren't really that good of friends. But what they said is, you know, let's set our problems aside and let's form an alliance that is known as, let me use red now, the First Triumvirate. What's implied in that designation? There will be a second. That'll be significant here in a bit. But what is this? What do you see in this word? Tri, which would be pointing to the three, the alliance of the three. They come together. First of all, the alliance is in secret. No one knows that they've just aligned together. But nevertheless, they all get together and they agree that their one target is not a single person. Their one target is the entire Senate. What they're going to do with all of their power, with all of their money, with all of their prestige and all of their honor is to attack the people that have snubbed them, the entire Senate, in the mold of Gracchus, Drusus, and Sulla. See what's happening? So, you have the first initial surge of power for the triumvirate. Caesar is elected consul of 59. In 59, he gets the highest office inside the co-consul. There's two consuls, okay? So you know what I mean by that. 59, he gets it, and he begins to push the political propaganda, the agenda of the triumvirate. All of a sudden, it starts to become public where his true allegiances align. And that becomes a problem because he's already in office. First thing Caesar does, is he first implements the award to Pompey's veterans that was denied by the Senate just 3 years earlier. Once again, whenever he suggests this is what he wants to do, Cato comes in and tries to block it. But what Caesar does is he decides, you know what? We're going to utilize force. He actually even has his fellow consul beat up to convince him to start pushing the agenda with him. And he goes around the Senate and has the measure approved anyway. What he's saying is we're coming after you. So now you have a whole bunch of veterans who were snubbed by the Senate who now have been given the honor that they felt they deserved by the triumvirate. Next thing that happens is Caesar then goes and he says, what you snubbed Crassus for, that tax rebate for the knights, other military men, we're going to give that too. And once again, Cato tries to reject it, and what happens is it's forcefully pushed through. These actions, though, start to show the allegiance of what Caesar actually has. The who has been snubbed by the Senate's now forming an alliance to even bypass the Senate to get secured what they want. And ultimately, if you get knights on your side and veterans of war, you're sitting in a good position. Just ask Sulla, Drusus, and Gracchus. The third thing he did was this. The third thing he did was pass a mandate that all of the proceedings of the Senate were to be published publicly. What would that do? Yeah, the hidden transcripts can no longer be used to either suppress the people or the triumvirate. Now everyone can see if there is something, a coup going against the triumvirate, Caesar, Pompey, or Crassus, it will be published in the public transcript. That's a problem. Just ask Julian Assange. Next thing they do, after this kind of starts to develop and they develop some more ways of securing their own power, the triumvirate has really kind of a resurgence in 56. In 56, so much had happened in the 3 to 6 years that they were snubbed and they gained some power that they have this meeting at Lucca. It's a secluded place. That's not significant. You don't need to know that for the oral exam. Say it again. Around 60. It was formed in secret, so we don't know exactly. But we do know that the three snubs happened in 62, 61, 60. Then the actual emergence of the power really begins in 59, even though they're probably in collusion before that. Lucca. They get together at Lucca in 56 to kind of reestablish how they're going to move forward in their power. Number one, they reestablish in that moment their commitment, their covenant with each other. They say, okay, we know we weren't friends coming into this, but we need to make sure that we're still on the same page. What's our target? The Senate. Okay. What are we going to do? Fight for each other. Okay. So they realign. The second thing they do is they make future plans. And there's going to be now subcategories of the future plans. Number one, Pompey and Crassus were to become the two consuls in 55. So they still were going to have sole power. The triumvirate had already had somebody in power all the way from 59 to 56. The next year, they were going to make sure that Pompey and Crassus become the consuls so they can continue to perpetuate their political influence. Number two, Crassus was okay with developing that power, but Crassus was really looking to accumulate some more military prestige. Remember I told you early on that Crassus was a part of Sulla's wars, but he didn't get any of the glory for it. And one of the ways you accumulate wealth in the ancient world is by having successful military conquests. So Crassus says, hey, will you guys put me in a place where I can have some more military victories? They said yes. And the assignment that he asked for was the Parthian Empire in the east. That's where Crassus goes. That will be significant later. All right, number three. Pompey would also be, in addition to being consul, he would also be the ruler, the one that is head over Spain for the next 5 years. That's one of the things they would push through. But he would be ruling in absentia in Spain. He would be ruler over Spain in title, but he would stay in Rome to make sure he can control all the administration so that Crassus can be out doing what he's doing. And then here comes the fourth thing. And Caesar also wanted more military conquests, so he got assigned to go to the Transalpine Gaul, which is in the northwest of the empire. So you have Crassus over in the east, you have Caesar up in the northwest region, and then you have Pompey in the middle in Rome. And this is what they secure in 56. But what happens over the next couple of years, we start to see the deterioration of the triumvirate. It starts to fall apart, and there's several reasons for that. First of all, in 54, you see, Pompey was married to Julius Caesar's daughter, Julia. So one of the ways they solidified their allegiance was Pompey married Julia, Julius Caesar's daughter. But in 54, Julia dies. So now they don't have this familial tie together. So Julius Caesar says, I know she died, but hey, let's come up with a new plan to make sure that our families are still tied together through marriage. And so he offers some other people in his families a way of being connected, and Pompey flat out rejects Julius Caesar's offer for a new wife. Instead, he marries a woman by the name of Cornelia. And Cornelia was the daughter of Metellus Scipio, which actually the name Scipio is pretty important from the Punic Wars, but we didn't have time to talk about him. Metellus Scipio. Cornelia is the daughter of Metellus Scipio, and the problem with that is that Metellus Scipio, he actually really was a heavy politician, an aristocrat. And he was a part of a party that hated Julius Caesar. It was very known he was a part of a party that wanted to dispose of Julius Caesar, get rid of him. So whenever Julia dies and Pompey snuffs the offer of Julius Caesar and instead marries and makes, in a sense, a familial allegiance with an enemy, that, understated, it strains the relationship between Caesar and Pompey. The second thing that happens in the deterioration of the triumvirate is in 53. 53, Crassus is killed. Crassus is killed. What happens is he's at the city of Carrhae in Mesopotamia on the edge of the Parthian Empire, and his army just gets destroyed. And so instead of losing everything, this is a very normal war tactic, is he decided to go out and meet the leaders of the Parthians in order to strike a deal. Matter of fact, the way they were destroyed was by the Parthians having 10,000 really well-trained archers on horseback, which may be an image in Revelation 9, but whatever. Matter of fact, they really called them cowards, because one of the ways the Parthians would, what they would do is they would come in, they have an initial surge where they'd hit a lot of cheap shots, and then they would retreat, and as the riders were riding, they would go backwards, and from the tail, they'd be shooting back at the Romans and just picking them off one at a time. Which may be one of the reasons why the locust in Revelation 9 have the scorpion tails that also can be used venomously. Anyway, and the Parthians did wear masks and have long flowing hair while they were doing this as well. Revelation 9. Anyone? Jeremy's not even here, so. Okay, don't tell him. So he goes out to negotiate. Crassus goes out to negotiate because his army had just been decimated. And instead of negotiating, they just execute him. So now we can't have a triumvirate, we have a biumvirate, because there's only two even alive now. And those two are even strained. And what ends up happening is, and this is kind of the straw that breaks the camel's back, in 50, Pompey was asked by the Senate to take control of all the forces of the Republic with Caesar as his target. Yeah. And Pompey accepts. Caesar sends a letter to the Senate. He says, hey, you know, basically appealing, protesting, this isn't right. He sends a letter, and it wasn't even allowed to be read in the Senate. Totally snuffed. As a result, all of Caesar's allies abandon Rome. They get out of Dodge. One of the people that was in Rome at the time, that was one of Caesar's key allies, was a man by the name of Mark Antony. They all get out of Dodge because they've just said, we've declared war on Caesar. And Pompey is the one they're commissioning to do this. So the triumvirate at this point is not working very well, okay? It's not in existence. But it's solidified on January 10th, 49 BC. January 10th, 49 BC. Oh yeah, by the way, today is Augustus Caesar's birthday, in case you're wondering. Isn't that just quaint? January 10th, 49 BC, Caesar crossed the border between Gaul and Italy with his army. Remember Sulla made the reformations that the general is not allowed to take his army along certain borders? Caesar intentionally crosses the border and declares war on Rome. Over the next year and a half, the largest civil war in the history of Rome ensues. Eventually, and I'm going to summarize this terribly, but we need to keep moving forward. What eventually happens is in 48 BC, Caesar wins, basically. Pompey actually doesn't die in the war in which Caesar was winning. Caesar, though, proved that he was a military genius whenever he went up against Pompey, who also was no military slouch himself. But the military tactics of Caesar, the devotion, the loyalty of the armies to Caesar, proved too much for Pompey. So Pompey fled and he goes to Egypt to find asylum. And the way that the story goes, the moment he landed on Egyptian soil, Pompey was killed because the Egyptian leader said, "We want to be on the winning side." And if you're fleeing, then you must not be winning. So he dies immediately. And as a result, whenever that happens, Caesar declares himself a key title that will eventually find its way etymologically. And we've already seen it on coins already. Very first time, though. He doesn't take the name dictator, he takes the name imperator, which literally means, imperator literally means the military commander who totally surpasses all others. That's the title he takes. Eventually you'll see etymologically it will become emperor, but even the word emperor has a militaristic background. Yeah.
Caesar, was that like a surname of his, or was that a title that was later ascribed?
No, yeah, this is his actual name.
Okay, so that became the title.
Yeah, this eventually, as an honorific way of keeping the legacy of Caesar alive, will become the name of all the future emperors. But no, that's his actual name. But we'll have to talk about that more tomorrow, because it's one after. So, I love you guys. See you tomorrow. And we will talk about the reign of Caesar and the rise of the second triumvirate.